Ladies and gentlemen, many of you, looking at the spectacle of the world around you, at the amount of destruction, horror, and suffering to be seen everywhere, at the apparent sweeping triumph of evil and the apparent helplessness of innocence and virtue, may find yourselves drawn irresistibly to the conclusion that the world is controlled by some diabolically clever, all but omnipotent evil power, capable of winning any and every battle against the good. Without necessarily naming it in words, you may feel that such inherently is the nature of life, that evil will always prove more practical and powerful than virtue, and that the good has no chance on earth. This, of course, is the essential view of existence held by all mystical moralities, the moralities that teach that man is born to suffer, that this earth is a realm to be escaped, that virtue must be content to be its own reward, that happiness is only possible beyond the grave, and that to seek or to achieve happiness in this world is proof of one's depravity, since only the depraved can profit in this life, and only the evil is practical. You who are here tonight would not accept the mystics' nonsense about another dimension or any of their promises of a self-fulfillment to be achieved by death. But to those among you who have succumbed to the feeling that only evil is practical on earth, to those of you who feel that there is an omnipotent monster running loose in the world, I want to say that that monster is in fact an impotent, panic-stricken little non-entity whose only source of strength, of power, of efficacy is you. In order to understand in what manner this is true, it is necessary first clearly to define what is evil, to identify its precise nature and meaning. It is your concept of the nature of evil that will determine your attitude toward it, that will determine whether what you feel for evil is fear or contempt. Evil, according to the mystic's doctrine of original sin, is that which man is by nature. It is that within him which pulls his soul downward toward the pursuit of earthly enjoyment. Evil, according to that tradition which has moved from the Orient to such mystery cults as the Orphics of ancient Greece, to Pythagoras, to Plato, to St. Paul, to St. Augustine, is the lust for this earth, the quest for pleasure, the pursuit of sexual enjoyment, the pursuit of happiness, of production, of trade, of profit, of wealth. Evil is, above all, arrogance, pride, the conviction that one's mind, unaided by divine revelation or insight, is competent to discover the truth. Mystics do not begin, as one rationally must, with a definition of the good by which they then define the evil. They begin instead with the standard of evil by which they then define the good. Their whole concept of good consists of a negation. The good is non-man, non-life on earth, non-profit, non-reason. It is significant in this respect that their cardinal virtue is self-sacrifice. Self-sacrifice is a negation, the wiping out, the surrendering, the renouncing of one's values, one's happiness, one's life, one's mind. In this sense, they regard evil metaphysically as active and the good as passive. By such a concept of good and evil, it is certainly true that virtue is impractical and vice is practical. The practical means that which is appropriate to the conditions of reality, that which works, succeeds, brings man happiness, profit, and fulfillment. If it is a vice to use one's mind and a virtue to renounce it, if it is a vice to produce but a virtue to be in need, if it is a vice to achieve values but a virtue to forsake them, if it is a vice to be happy but a virtue to suffer, then most certainly the evil is practical and virtue has no chance on earth. But such, in fact, are not the evils which people believe to be practical. The consequence of the mystics' creed that removed morality from life has been to lead men to the belief that actual evils, such as dishonesty, robbery, brutality, are practical. The real alternative to the mystics' morality of death, the morality of life, has never been grasped by men. Failing to think outside the context of the mystics' definitions, they have concluded that if it is moral to place one's faith in the authority of God, it is practical to place one's faith in private whims. That if it is moral to give one's wealth away, it is practical to obtain wealth by force. That if it is moral to sacrifice oneself to others,
it is practical to sacrifice others to oneself, that if it is moral to be a masochist, it is practical to be a sadist. Men have so divorced the concept of morality from the practical problems of existence that if one were to tell them that the alleged virtues of the mystics are not moral, but rationality, honesty, justice, productiveness are, many might agree, but then, still caught in the mystic's trap, they would proceed to feel that rationality, honesty, justice, and productiveness are impractical, since the moral can have no chance on earth. Morality has become for them virtually a stigma. To call an action moral is, no matter what its nature, to brand it as impractical. If you wish to avoid this error, if you wish fully to understand what is good and evil, you must reject the basic approach of the mystics. You must remember that a rational morality, a morality proper to man's nature, is the tool not of man's destruction, but of his survival. That man needs a moral code for the most practical purpose possible in order to live. What is the definition of the good by objectivist ethics? It is that which supports man's survival, that which furthers and enhances man's existence, that which makes possible the achievement of life and the enjoyment of life. The purpose of morality, states Galt, is to teach you not to suffer and die, but to enjoy yourself and live. As I have said, only if one begins with a definition of the good can one rationally arrive at a definition of the evil. Only if one begins with a definition of one's basic goal or purpose can one judge what furthers that purpose or defeats it. Life is man's basic moral purpose, and the good is all that which human survival requires. What then is the evil? It is the anti-life. What does man's life depend on? First and foremost, upon reason, upon the perception of reality and adherence to reality. The essence of evil, then, is willful blindness to reality. It is defiance of the facts of reality. To give a simple illustration, if a man recklessly drives his car 100 miles an hour down an icy road, deliberately risking his life and that of the other passengers who are with him, for no other purpose than the thrill of seeing if he can get away with being flagrantly irrational, this is most profoundly evil. Evil because it is anti-reality, anti-reason, and therefore anti-life. The moral is the rational, the evil is the irrational. And remember that this means that the moral is that which is in accordance with reality and the evil is that which attempts to go against the facts of reality. Within man's consciousness, the issue of good and evil consists of a single choice, the only basic choice open to man, to think or not to think, to perceive reality or to evade the responsibility of perceiving it. To quote Galt, quote, thinking is man's only basic virtue from which all the others proceed, and his basic vice, the source of all his evils, is that nameless act which all of you practice but struggle never to admit, the act of blanking out, the willful suspension of one's consciousness, the refusal to think, not blindness but the refusal to see, not ignorance but the refusal to know. It is the act of unfocusing your mind and inducing an inner fog to escape the responsibility of judgment on the unstated premise that a thing will not exist if only you refuse to identify it, that A will not be A so long as you do not pronounce the verdict, it is. Non-thinking is an act of annihilation, a wish to negate existence, an attempt to wipe out reality. But existence exists. Reality is not to be wiped out. It will merely wipe out the wiper. Close quote. All the evils which you see around you, the bewildering contradictions in people's behavior, the dishonesties, the acts of cruelty, of destruction, of expropriation, of torture, of murder, proceed from and are made possible only by the evasions and blankouts of the guilty parties, by their willful suspension of their minds, their blind surrender to blind emotions, their rejection of reason and existence. Evil is self-made blindness. In order to make oneself evil, one is first to make oneself stupid. All the values required for man's survival have to be achieved by virtues. Food, shelter, clothing, happiness, and self-esteem all necessitate positive actions that man must perform, first the action of thinking, then the action of translating one's thought into physical form. Virtue does not consist of a negation. It does not consist of passivity or resignation or renunciation or self-sacrifice. It consists of positive action, of self-assertion, of achievement. It is evil, not virtue, that is a negation. Evil is non-thought, non-reason, non-reality, non-effort, non-achievement, non-life. And the result of evil in reality is not creation but destruction, not happiness but suffering, not self-fulfillment but self-defeat. Man cannot grow food by refusing to think. He cannot build a bridge by refusing to think. He cannot develop a new industry by refusing to think. He cannot cure diseases by refusing to think. He cannot achieve the conviction that he is competent and worthy to live by refusing to think. What can man achieve by refusing to think? Concentration camps and insane asylums. The error made by many people is the belief that any rebellion against the traditional mystical altruist morality is automatically and necessarily practical. This is palpably false. Ascetic submission and blind surrender to faith in the will of God is not practical, but neither is hedonistic womb-worshipping. Self-sacrifice is not practical, but neither is the sacrifice of others. Lying on a bed of nails and being fed by the charity of others is not practical, but neither is robbery and murder. Masochism is not practical, but neither is sadism. By what standard are all these things declared to be impractical? By the standard of life and happiness. In the deepest and most metaphysical sense, virtue means efficacy. Evil means impotence. By the standard of life and that which life requires, the mystic who spends his time in a self-induced trance, the criminal and the dictator are all equally impotent, all equally ineffectual, all equally incompetent to live. In judging the issue of efficacy and impotence, do not make the error of equating the power to create with the power to destroy. It is not by means of destruction that man achieves his survival. Would you wish to claim that a surgeon who saves a life and a homicidal maniac who takes a life are equally potent and efficacious? Would you wish to claim that a scientist who invents a serum to protect man against disease and a barbarian who slaughters a whole village are equally competent to deal with reality? Would you equate the power of an artist who paints a great canvas with the power of some hysterically envious rival who sets fire to it? Would you equate the efficacy of a businessman who creates a fortune with the efficacy of some hoodlum who robs him? You can hold these men as equally potent only on the premise that there is no significant difference between life and death. If it makes no difference whether a man lives or dies, then it is true that the creator and the killer are equally competent. Except that without the standard of life, concepts such as competent, efficacious, and potent no longer have any intelligible meaning. Observe that man does not have to work hard to struggle and to exert the effort of thought in order to achieve the state of impotence. He has merely to abstain from thinking. Impotence is not an achievement. It is the absence of an achievement. But efficacy is an achievement. It is the reward and the result of thinking. Man is not born efficacious. He is born only with potentialities that he must choose to actualize. To make himself competent to live is man's basic moral responsibility. Man must choose to think and to discover the values proper to him. The alternative to the mystic's doctrine of original sin is not a doctrine of original virtue. The alternative to the belief that man is born evil is not the belief that man is born good. Yet this is the explicit or implicit assumption of many people. They do not believe that virtue represents a positive achievement. They believe it is inherent in man's nature and that it is maintained merely by abstaining from vice. And thus they make virtue passive and vice active. But precisely the reverse is true. It is virtue that is active and vice that is passive. It is virtue that is a positive and vice that is a negative. It is virtue that is the result of effort and vice that results from non-effort. Many people make this error without identifying it consciously, without holding it as a conviction in words, but holding it only as the unfated implication of their premises. Let me give you an example. A man might open the newspaper and see the bright, smiling face of an attractive, intelligent child. He then reads that the child in the picture has been wantonly beaten and murdered by some kidnapper who, it was discovered, had no intention of ever returning the child, even if he obtained the ransom. Now, to feel strong moral indignation at such a story is surely normal and rational. But suppose the man reading the story feels more than that. He feels, let's say, a literal metaphysical horror, bordering almost on personal fear. A horror is at the sight not merely of the depraved, but of the metaphysically impossible and inconceivable. He feels, in effect, how could the kidnapper be so unutterable a monster as to turn against and destroy the life of an innocent child? Implicit in his feeling is the belief that, fully as much as himself, the kidnapper clearly perceived the value of a child's life, and yet chose, for no real reason whatever, to destroy that life. This, if it were literally true, would be psychologically and metaphysically incomprehensible and inconceivable. But such is not the actual nature of the kidnapper's evil. He is fully as much a monster as the man believes, but for a different reason. The kidnapper's evil is not that, having achieved the full understanding of the value of a human life, he still chose to commit a wanton murder, but that he never chose to the level of understanding the value of a human life. He arrested his thinking on so primitively savage a level that human life had no meaning to him one way or the other. To appreciate the value of human life as a moral achievement that kidnapper never chose to reach, that is his evil. This does not mean that the kidnapper would have no consciousness that he was doing wrong. He would have a chronic consciousness of doing wrong. But he would not perceive the nature and meaning of his evil with the clarity of the man reading the newspaper. If he saw the issue as that man saw it, he would not have committed the murder. And his depravity is that he didn't see it. What made the kidnapper's evil possible? The thinking he failed to do. To give you another example, I know that some of you have been hurt, bewildered, and shocked when, giving friends of yours the Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged to read, you saw your friends turn against and denounce the books after they had read them. You felt, in effect, that the values of the books were so self-evident, so inescapably clear, that no human mind could possibly fail to perceive, understand, and appreciate them. Now, if your friends did fully perceive and understand what is in the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and still were antagonistic, that would indeed be psychologically bewildering and, in fact, incomprehensible. But that is not what happened. It is not that they knew fully what was in the books, but chose to turn against it. Their guilt is that they did not choose to know what was in the books. That they threw their minds out of focus the first time they came across something that clashed with their neurotic values. That in reading the books, they were engaged not in the process of perception, but in the process of distortion, with their emotions doing the distorting and directing their judgment. Their guilt is not that they know who is John Galt but turned against him, but that they never achieved the state of knowing who is John Galt. What made their evil possible? The thinking they failed to do. If you feel admiration for Atlas Shrugged, this is a moral achievement. You were not born possessing the premises necessary to experience such admiration. If you possess those premises now, then that is the result of the thinking you have chosen to do. Every value of man, every rational premise, and every piece of knowledge has to be achieved. Virtue is not original. It is originated. Vice is the absence of virtue. Virtue is not the absence of vice. Death is the absence of life. Life is not the absence of death. Now then, if evil is impotent, if by its nature it can have no power, the question which logically arises is this: how has it been possible for evil to win the victories it has won? Granted that all the irrational can achieve is destruction, what has enabled it to achieve even that on such a wide scale? The answer, ladies and gentlemen, is this: evil, left to its own devices, is powerless. But evil has not been left to its own devices. It has been able to survive by harnessing and placing the power of the good in its service. If, for instance, a man who was totally irrational was left completely alone, he would perish. If he did not choose to think, to perceive reality, and to act in accordance with the facts of reality, if he did not choose to work and produce, he would quickly cease to clutter up the universe with his presence. There is only one way in which such a man could survive while remaining irrational. If he could, somehow, persuade an at least partially rational man to support him, to carry him on his energy. If he could, somehow, devise a means to drain the power of reason. But in such case, observe that it is still reason that the irrationalist needs in order to remain alive. It is still the efficacy of reason that the irrationalist has to count on and ride on. It is still only reason that permits men to exist. The simplest illustration of this principle would be a mooching parasite who gets a productive man to feed him by persuading the productive man that it is his moral duty to do so. The whole purpose of altruism and the creed of self-sacrifice is to gain precisely this end, to harness the power of the good and to place it at the disposal of the evil. But altruism is only one of the means, though certainly a major one, by which evil is enabled to feed off the blood of virtue. There are others which I shall discuss. One of the most graphic pictures of the inherent impotence of evil and of the way in which it requires the power of the good is presented in The Fountainhead through the relationships of Ellsworth Toohey, Gail Wyland, and Howard Roark. A man such as Toohey could never, alone and unaided, be any sort of threat to Roark. Toohey would not be able to create a newspaper through which to broadcast his ideas to millions of readers. It was Wyland who gave Toohey his voice. It was Wyland's energy and genius that was needed to create the newspaper chain, by means of which Toohey was enabled to attack Roark. Wyland was a man of mixed premises. He was a man with tremendous virtues, but also with disastrous flaws. Flaws that permitted him to do what a Roark would never do. Give Toohey a job and allow him to write the kind of collectivist column he wrote. Because of Wyman's errors, Toohey was able to ride on Wyman's paper, to ride on Wyman's ability, and to make it the means of Wyman's own destruction. At the climax of the novel, when Wyman reads the denunciation of Roark in his own newspaper, The Banner, it is the realization of who made it possible that spiritually finishes Wynand. He thinks, quote, "There is a beast on earth, damned safely by its own impotence. I broke the dam. They would have remained helpless, and they can produce nothing. I gave them the weapon. I gave them my strength, my energy, my living power. I created a great voice and let them dictate the words," close quote. When Wyland closes The Banner and fires Toohey, Toohey is left to start his struggle for power all over again. What is the first thing he does when he gets a job on another newspaper? He begins to inquire about the possible weaknesses and flaws of his new employer. If that employer did not have certain virtues, there would be no newspaper for Toohey to get a job on. If he did not have certain flaws, there would be no job offered to Toohey and no way by which Toohey could ride on his virtues. Just as evil is efficacious in human relationships only to the extent that it can place the power of virtue in its service, so the same principle obtains within the soul of a single man. Consider the case of Dr. Robert Stadler and Atlas Shrugged. If Dr. Stadler did not have certain enormous virtues, if he was not a man of great scientific achievement, he would not have acquired the prestige necessary to influence the country to establish a state science institute. Stadler's evil was that he wanted a state science institute, that is, a laboratory paid for by loot. But the evil in him was able to obtain its desires only by means of the good in him, only by means of his tremendous prestige, which came from the greatness of his mind. If Stadler had been totally without virtues, if he had never chosen to think at all, if he were an undistinguished mediocrity, he would be helpless and unable to gain his irrational ends, unless he found a way to exploit the virtues of some other men as the looters exploited his virtue. Men such as Wesley Mouch and Floyd Ferris would not be able to create a Project X. They needed the scientific discoveries of a Stadler. Their power came from his genius. What made it possible for them to use him? Stadler's very own flaws. Omitting the help Soviet Russia gets from the outside world, if in Russia today there are any scientists of authentic ability, men who are willing to work under the conditions of slavery, to think, to produce, and to blank out the question of what end their work is serving, It is they who make the continued existence of Soviet Russia possible. The man of ability who is willing to work but is indifferent to questions of morality, indifferent to the question of what his work is supporting, indifferent to such vulgarly practical issues as firing squads, slave labor camps, and torture chambers, that man is the ideal slave for every dictator. And such a man of ability is the guiltiest man on earth. Left to his own devices, a Khrushchev couldn't even spell cyclotron, let alone create one. It is the man of mixed premises, the man who is part good, part evil, who is most responsible for any victories that evil wins and any harm done to the good. Consider the case of a businessman who is authentically competent, who has earned his fortune, but who is also a liberal, who feels guilty about making money and contributes to the support of collectivist causes. To the extent to which those causes succeed, to the extent to which they have an influence, they have achieved it by means of the fuel of virtue. Observe how the same principle works on the personal level. If someone you love turns irrational and thereby causes you pain, identify what gave him the power to cause you that pain. If you had not seen some sort of value in him, if you had not seen something which you considered good, you would be indifferent to his character one way or the other. If his flaws hurt you, it was his virtues that made it possible. A man who is totally and unequivocally evil would not be able to deceive you. You would not reach the stage of feeling love or affection for him, and so would not be vulnerable to shock and disappointment. Do you hear it said that not everyone is black and white? Well, that is true. And it is the people who are gray who cause most of the suffering in the world. There is another form, perhaps the most tragic one, of the manner in which the good supports the evil and makes the success of evil possible. These are the countless situations where men of virtue help evil, not because of their own evasions, weaknesses, or flaws, but because of their own virtues, because of their own innocence, honesty, generosity, endurance, and sense of justice. Innocence is the key virtue in such cases, the virtue most viciously exploited. Men who are fundamentally rational are unable to conceive of the kind of motives that prompt the irrational. They do not understand the nature of evil and do not know how to identify its symptoms. Their own honesty makes them regard the wrong actions of others as mere errors of knowledge. Their generosity makes them feel benevolence toward others and reluctant to suspect the worst. Their endurance makes them willing to bear a good deal of undeserved pain on the assumption that those who caused it didn't do it intentionally. Their own sense of justice makes them unable to condemn others without understanding and leads them to give others too much benefit of the doubt for too long. This is the error which Ayn Rand calls the sanction of the victim.
sanction of the victim means the willingness to let one's own virtues be used by others against oneself. It means the willingness to bear injustice, to take actions which help others against one's own rational self-interest, and to concede moral validity to the claims of one's own destroyers. Hank Reardon in Atlas Shrugged is an archetypical example of the man who makes this error. The suffering he endured through the years of his marriage to Lillian was not caused by the power of Lillian's evil, but by his own mistaken sanction of her evil. She had no power at all, except the power of his own virtues, which he was letting her use against him. Her only weapons were his virtues, his sense of justice, which made him unwilling to condemn her so long as he could not understand her motives. His sense of honor, which made him unwilling to break his word to divorce her so long as he had no proof of her guilt. His scrupulous conscientiousness, which made him take the blame for any pain he might have caused her, while allowing her to inflict an enormous amount of suffering on him. His generosity, which made him unwilling to hurt her and let her torture him by means of nothing but his own compassion for her. His self-esteem, which made him unable to conceive that any human being could sink to her degree of depravity. Once he understood her character and withdrew his sanction, he destroyed her weapons. She had no power to hold him or to harm him any longer. The injustice he was willing to tolerate on the part of his mother and his brother was made possible by the same error and the same generosity. By his recognition of their helplessness and their total dependence upon him, by his unwillingness to hurt them, by his consideration for their feelings while they showed none for him, and by his inability to conceive of their kind of malice. His relationship to the society around him, and particularly to the looters, the collectivist intellectuals, the bureaucrats, the economic planners, followed the same pattern. He was unable at first to understand their motives and their nature. He felt contempt for the vicious irrationality of their ideas, but he thought that he was dealing with nothing worse than a gang of fools who merely wanted to seize some part of his wealth. He regarded them as mere criminals motivated by material greed for the unearned, which incidentally is an error shared by many people today about the real nature of collectivism. What was the looters' power over him? It was not the power of their guns. Their guns could kill him, but they could not force him to think, to work, to produce. And what the looters wanted was not to kill him, but to enslave him, to make him work for their benefit, and supply them with the wealth they needed for their own survival. He was not motivated by fear, nor by any desire to appease them. What then made him accept their injustices, impositions, regulations, and expropriations, and continue to work? Nothing but the power of his own virtues. His love of life, his creative ambition, his endurance, his refusal to surrender to pain or to give up in the face of obstacles, his determination to work a little harder is the answer to every disaster, and his confidence that the right would win, that reason is invincible, and that irrationality is self-defeating. This last was true, of course, but what he had to learn was that reason cannot and must not be placed in the service of irrationality, that his enemies were destroying him by means of his own power. When he grasped it and withdrew his power, when he went on strike, the enormous machine of the collectivist government, with all of its guns, thugs, and directives, lost all of its power over him. It could not hold him or make him work. Now, observe that the crucial cause in any instance of the sanction of the victim is the absence of moral objectivity, which is caused by the absence of an objective moral code. Reardon, as well as all the other men whom Galt called out on the strike, had been acting implicitly on a moral code of their own, the code of life, but they did not know it explicitly, they did not know how profound the moral issue it represented, and they were unable to prove the objective validity of their code. They were in effect forced into the position of subjectivists. Reardon knew that his code, his values, and his actions were right for him, but he could not prove that they were objectively right for everyone, and so long as he could not prove it, he remained morally disarmed and defenseless. This made him give the benefit of the doubt to Lillian, to his family, to the society around him, even though he saw them committing actions which he would never permit himself, actions which, by his code, were contemptible and evil. When men do not have an objective moral code, a code that can be rationally defined, proved, understood, and applied, the result in all social relationships works to the detriment of the good and to the advantage of the evil. An honest, rational man will struggle to be just to others with no standard by which to determine what is just. And this leaves the door wide open for every miserable little whim worshiper, every sniveling faker of reality, every posturing evader who will be only too glad to rush forward with his claims to the unearned and undeserved without caring about any question of justice. A man of self-esteem would never want to take advantage of others, neither in spiritual nor in material issues, because he would not want to sink to the level of a parasite who takes the unearned in any form. When in doubt, he would accept a burden rather than switch it to others. This suits perfectly the interests of those men who do not possess self-esteem and are not concerned with their own moral purity. The evaders, the moochers, the parasites. The morality of altruism, of self-sacrifice, is an institutionalized sanction of the victim. No one can ever accept it fully or practice it. But the extent to which a conscientious man might attempt to practice it, at least in part, he becomes the victim who sanctions the evil of his own destroyers, of those who do not mind accepting the sacrifices of others. What altruism has actually accomplished is a state of moral agnosticism in human relationships, so that the best among men act on private, unidentified common sense morality of their own and are helpless against the evil of the worst among men. If you wish to avoid the trap and the errors of the sanction of the victim, you must learn to pronounce objective moral judgments. You must learn to distinguish in any given situation whether the fault is yours or whether others are taking advantage of you unjustly. This is not always easy to determine, particularly in complex issues and relationships, but justice is the standard which you must learn to apply if you want to arrive at the proper moral estimate. There are two principles to remember in such cases, two characteristics involved in all instances of the sanction of the victim. First, avoid granting anyone any double standard at your own expense. The immorality of using a double standard for your own advantage is generally recognized, as, for instance, permitting yourself the kind of evil actions that you condemn in others. But this is a flaw practiced by men who are fundamentally immoral. What is not generally recognized is the same flaw practiced in reverse and for nobler motives by men who are moral, the mistake of tolerating in others the kind of evils that you would condemn in yourself. Whenever you are able to say about some immoral action, with full rational knowledge of your reasons, "I would not permit myself to do this," do not accept, tolerate, forgive, or sanction it when it is done by others. Second, a characteristic attribute of all the situations that involve the sanction of the victim is the fact that you are made to suffer by means of your virtues, not by means of your flaws. If you are made to suffer because of your flaws, if you are blamed, denounced, punished, or hurt because of your own actions, which you know to be evil, this is merely justice, and a rational person will accept it as justice and will work to correct his flaws. But if you find yourself in a situation where the source of your pain is your virtues, where your honesty or fairness or compassion or consideration for others cause you suffering, a suffering you would avoid if you were dishonest, unfair, cruel, or inconsiderate, why then look out. Look for the person who is taking advantage of your virtues and using them against you. And do not hesitate to withdraw your sanction when you discover the culprit. This does not mean that you have to abandon your virtues and become dishonest, unfair, or cruel. It means that you must not allow such vices to others. It means that you have to be just. The simplest example would be a situation which unfortunately occurs too often. If your mother demands that you make a sacrifice for her sake, that you give up the career you want or the girl you love because it makes her unhappy, she is counting on the sanction of the victim. She is counting on your love for her or your consideration to make you suffer. She is using your love for her as a weapon to cause you unhappiness, an unhappiness you would escape if you were indifferent to her. In such a case, you must point out to her the injustice of her policy and refuse to comply. This does not make you cruel and inconsiderate. It merely forbids her to be cruel and inconsiderate. The instances and examples of the sanction of the victim in human relationships are literally countless and involve the whole range of possibilities, from the trivial to the most crucial, from petty chiseling to major depravity. For instance, the worthless relative who is always in trouble and keeps running to you for help to save him from the consequences of his actions. He keeps borrowing from you because he has no food in the house or is about to be evicted by his landlord or needs a new suit to look for a job or has no car fare to go home, etc., etc. With a grossly, stubbornly blind indifference to the question of your needs, your problems, or the hardships which this constant financial drain imposes on you, what is he counting on? Your concern for him and your pity. The extreme of such counting on pity occurs when you finally refuse to help the bum any further, and he then proceeds to forge your signature on the check or to charge purchases to your charge account, feeling certain that you would not prosecute him, that you would not want to get him in trouble or send him to jail, giving no thought whatever to the trouble his action will leave you in. Any parent or relative who sanctions this sort of procedure deserves the kind of consequences that he gets. Another example is a sort of pest whom most of you have encountered at one time or another, the man who comes to visit you in the afternoon and stays on, showing no sign or intention to leave, knowing that you will ultimately have to invite him to stay for dinner. What is he counting on? Well, he's obviously counting on your politeness, on your consideration for his feelings, which will make you put up with an imposition rather than embarrass him by asking him to leave. The same sort of victimizing is perpetrated by any friends or acquaintances who drop in on you uninvited and unannounced and bore you with pointless jabber, counting on your politeness to prevent you from telling them that you have other things to do. Then there is the man who will always ignore the check when you go to a restaurant together and will always leave you to pay it. What is he counting on? On the fact that a man of self-esteem will feel reluctance to be petty and will not raise the issue. The same abuse of magnanimity is committed by the girl who asks her escort to take her to the most expensive place in town while knowing that he can't afford it. Or by the man who, in an office, impresses the boss by quoting as his own some idea which he learned from you, counting on you to be too big to make a fuss over it. Then there is the poor relative whom you are supporting or the inefficient employee whom you are tolerating, who goes out of his way to assert his independence by being offensive, insulting, or impertinent toward you, knowing that you will not reciprocate. He is counting on the consideration which strength will usually show for weakness. He is counting on you to put up with abuse precisely because you hold him in your power and will generously refrain from reminding him of it. The attitude of Philip toward Hank Reardon is an illustration of this. A more complex form of victimizing is committed by the kind of people who quarrel with you and make no effort to resolve the quarrel yet expect the relationship to continue. They are counting on a rational man's desire not to leave disagreements unsolved, and they will pout or sulk or evade while you are struggling conscientiously to understand the situation, to identify it, to bring the relationship into some form of rational order. Any person who, in any situation, business or personal, pulls the line, "Don't you trust me," is making a double use of the sanction of the victim. This line is always used in situations where the victim wants objective proof and is asked to substitute trust for objectivity. In business relationships, it comes up in such terms as, "We don't need a written agreement, don't you trust me?" Or, "You don't have to read this long document, just sign it, don't you trust me?" Or, "Oh, I know that this clause in our proposed contract gives me the power to act without consulting you, but I'd never do that, so sign it. Don't you trust me?" In personal relationships, it comes up when you question the puzzling or contradictory actions of a wife, a husband, or a friend, who, instead of offering you an explanation, acts offended at your suspiciousness and lack of trust. The double victimizing involved is as follows. First, the desire for objectivity is not the equivalent of mistrust, and the victimizer is putting you on the spot, counting on your reluctance to imply that you consider him dishonest. Second, any man who demands trust is either consciously planning to cheat you or is the type of man who wants to reserve for himself that possibility just in case, because he dislikes the restrictions of an absolute commitment and prefers the freedom of dealing with undefined, elastic situations. As practical advice, I suggest that you must never sanction demands of this kind. The proper answer to give is simply that it is not an issue of mistrust, but a matter of principle and objectivity. We have been discussing some of the examples of the sanction of the victim
that one encounters in one's daily private life. Now observe the same issue and the same principle of victimizing as it works on a wider social and political scale. The essence of the policy of any dictatorship consists of counting on the sanction of its victims, and it is only the virtue of its victims that makes it possible for a dictatorship to survive. A statist collectivist society of any kind, whether communist or Nazi, represents, I quote from Atlas Shrugged, quote, millions of men being held in bondage by means of their desire to live, by means of their energy drained in forced labor, by means of their ability to feed their masters, by means of the hostage system, of their love for their children or wives or friends, by means of love, ability, and pleasure as the fodder for threats and the bait for extortion. With love tied to fear, ability to punishment, ambition to confiscation, with blackmail as law, with escape from pain, not quest for pleasure, is the only incentive to effort and the only reward for achievement. Men held enslaved by means of whatever living power they possessed and of whatever joy they found in life. Close quote. What makes so enormous an evil possible? The sanction of those who live under a dictatorship and the less innocent sanction of those outside who either regard it as a noble experiment and a moral ideal, or who give it the benefit of the doubt. The majority of people living under a dictatorship do not consider it an ideal, but neither do they identify it as the kind of evil it is. Most of them sanction it by trying to make terms with it instead of realizing its nature and adopting an attitude of unbending, uncompromising, total, absolute condemnation. A moral condemnation which, even without any chance at physical rebellion, would destroy any dictatorship. The far greater guilt, of course, is the guilt of those outside, of any liberal who advocates cultural exchange with a dictatorship, of any businessman who advocates trade with a dictatorship, of any politician who advocates deals, treaties, and compromises. Some of these people may be merely fools, some are much worse, but the real sanction of the victim is given by the enormous majority of people in the world who sanction those compromisers and thus lend them moral respectability. To understand this clearly, project what would happen in the criminal underworld if the so-called best people of America, the cultural leaders, the professors, the writers, the socialites, the businessmen, the judges, began to invite avowed kidnappers and gangsters to their homes and to treat them as moral equals who have a mere difference of opinion about one's way of making a living. How long would our society remain civilized or be able to maintain even a semblance of the civilized? If you see the point, you understand the way in which it is not the intrinsic power of evil, but the sanction of the victims that makes evil possible on a global scale. To the extent to which the mixed economy shares some of the principles of a dictatorship, the same evils and the same errors can be observed within it. What is the attitude of the American businessmen toward the liberals but an enormous sanction of the victim? There may be individual exceptions, which are heard in public less and less frequently, but the majority of businessmen, by conviction or by default, keep apologizing for their virtues, for their achievements, for their profits, and promising to assume more social responsibility, while the liberals keep piling demands, reproaches, insults, and controls upon them. What is a major source of collectivist propaganda today and the funds for fostering such propaganda? The educational foundations established and endowed by such industrial giants of capitalism as Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, Rockefeller, Sloan, and many, many others. It is not the power of evil, of collectivism, that created these foundations, but the power of the good, the misguided, misinformed power of productive men, none of whom was a collectivist, but who created the means for the destruction of everything they valued. If you want proof on a grand scale of the manner in which the triumph of evil is made possible only by the help of the good, observe the political relationship between the so-called free world and Soviet Russia, particularly since World War II. All the successes of Soviet Russia in the so-called Cold War were caused not by any diabolical cleverness on the part of Russia, but by the compromises, surrenders, and cooperation of the free countries, by their lack of moral and intellectual certainty, by their acceptance of the base of collectivist premises, by their weak, irrational, uncertain, vacillating policy, a policy devoid of any purpose, meaning, or moral integrity. Did Russia produce the $11 billion worth of supplies she received during World War II? No, it was handed over to her by the United States. Did Russia defeat Nazi Germany? No, she was being beaten shamefully and retreating as fast as her troops could move until American supplies arrived to help her. Did Russia conquer Berlin? No, American troops deliberately held back in order to let the Russians enter. Who created the preposterous situation of a divided Berlin and of the so-called corridor? Who created a divided Korea and then forbade its soldiers to fight to victory in the ensuing war? Who is draining its own economy to give economic assistance to such defenders of freedom as Tito, Nehru, Castro, and to such strongholds of liberty as communist Poland? Who is pleading with the small countries of the world to form a common front against communism and sanctioning communism by joining Russia in the United Nations, allegedly an institution dedicated to the protection of the world against aggression, which then proceeds to sanction every act of aggression by Russia, every outrage against small countries in the last 15 years? Who achieved all that? The power of Soviet Russia? Communism, like every other evil, is winning by default. It is winning like disease germs that are powerless against a healthy body, but rush in to take over when the healthy, that is, the good, have broken down their own resistance. In large-scale social issues, as well as in private lives, the decisive factor is the moral code of those involved. Whoever sets the moral terms of a society sets its course. When the prevalent morality is on the side of evil, such as the morality of altruism, or when the prevalent state has a moral vacuum, such as the public mood of today, then evil wins, but only by means of the sanction of its victims. It is this sanction that a rational morality must teach men to withdraw. An important corollary to this issue is the question of forgiveness. An indiscriminate, overgenerous granting of forgiveness is one of the ways in which victims help their own destroyers and foster the victory of evil. The altruist morality teaches men to regard forgiveness, the forgiveness of anything, of any crime, of any evil, of any atrocity, as a primary virtue, a virtue in itself regardless of the consequences and out of context. This is the meaning of the admonition to turn the other cheek. I discussed in my lecture on justice the consequences of mercy and the manner in which mercy leads to the sacrifice of the good to the evil. Mercy is the granting of an undeserved forgiveness, and any form of undeserved forgiveness will lead to the same results. An undeserved forgiveness means that you save a person from the consequences of his evil action. But since the consequences are objective facts, and since you cannot wipe facts out of existence by means of your wish or your kindness, the only way you can save a person from the consequences of his evil is by switching these consequences to yourself or to some other innocent person. For instance, if you pay the bills of a parasitical mooching relative, it is you who then absorb the consequences of his irrationality. If an irresponsible friend asks you to give him a good reference for a job and you do so, you are switching the consequences of his irrationality to the employer. The employer takes your word and hires an inefficient and reliable employee who will cause him troubles and losses. Since all evil in essence consists of evading or defying the facts of reality, reality would teach a man very rapidly that evil is impractical, and men would learn it or they would perish if you and other victims were not there to forgive them, to absorb their punishment, and thus let them try to get away with greater and still greater evils. If you do this, then don't stare at the world and moan that evil seems to be all-powerful. Don't ask where the power of evil comes from. Ladies and gentlemen, it comes from you. The forgiveness of evil declares to the evildoer that he can defy reality with impunity and that someone will make it possible for him. That is all the encouragement he needs. An evildoer is a man who is fighting against the restrictions which a rational universe places on his whims. Your forgiveness grants him his dream. An irrational universe. This is the metaphysical implication of any help one grants to evil by any form of undeserved forgiveness, and these will always be the inexorable consequences, whether on a large public scale or on a modest scale of the most obscure private life. It is the countless private forgivenesses that unleash evil in the world. To paraphrase a very important line of Galt's, it is of such private forgivenesses that the power of evil is made. But the alternative to promiscuous forgiveness is not the policy of holding grudges. When, then, is it proper to forgive an evil action? Why? When that forgiveness is deserved. Since man's moral character is the product of his free will, a man is always free to correct his evil premises. He is not bound for life to his vices, and he is not to be damned for them forever if he succeeds in correcting them. unless he has committed such monstrous crimes that no atonement and no forgiveness is possible, which would be the case of a dictator or a murderer. To deserve forgiveness, a man must atone for his evil in fact and in action, not merely in a verbal declaration of repentance. He must grasp the evil premise that caused his actions, and he must reject it fully and consciously with a full intellectual understanding, not merely by emotional protestations. He must undo and correct the existential consequences of his evil actions to the extent to which it is still possible, and he must give you proof of his change, of his better premises, in the same terms in which his evil was committed. Only then is it proper and just to forgive him. For instance, if a man has defrauded you of money, he must repay that money and give you the evidence of many honest, honorable actions before you will be justified in concluding that he is now honest, and then forgive the past. If a husband has been unfaithful, he must give you objective evidence of his love for you and a long period of fidelity before you will be justified in forgiving him. If a man had been a communist, he must offer a long record of fighting for capitalism before he is given a job on the conservative magazine or in the State Department. In order to be just, one must always remember the difference between errors of knowledge and breaches of morality. Errors of knowledge are not a moral flaw and cannot be held against a man, since man is not omniscient. Such errors become moral flaws only if and when a man refuses to correct them. Breaches of morality are the willful, volitional choice of an action which one knows to be evil. Honest errors of knowledge must be given every benefit of the doubt and every possible allowance. But a breach of morality must not be forgiven, nor accepted, nor sanctioned in any manner. Many moral issues are extremely complex, and it is not always easy to determine the man's moral guilt. But I can suggest to you one absolute, one kind of action which is unmistakably, unquestionably, and totally evil, and which you must never tolerate, accept, or forgive without correction. And that is any rejection of reason, any avowed refusal to be rational, any refusal to think, any open, explicit policy of slamming one's mental door on a rational argument and declaring one's intention to defy reason. If you accept that and continue any sort of friendly relationship with such a person, you are an accessory after the fact, and you'll deserve what you'll get. From two different aspects, ladies and gentlemen, most people overestimate evil and underestimate it. They overestimate it in the sense of believing that it is powerful and practical. They underestimate it in the sense of not grasping its real nature, not grasping how evil really is. That, too, is a result of the altruist morality. So long as people associate evil with the enjoyment of life, with self-assertive confidence, with pride, strength, daring, and luxury, so long as they hold the concept of the charming rogue, the villain of countless novels and movies, who is so much more attractive and colorful than the boring, conventionally virtuous hero, so long as their symbol of evil is Lucifer, the most handsome of angels, who fell for no greater sin than arrogance, a quality which is far from being necessarily undesirable, so long as they hold such views, people will not rebel against evil. They will not feel the kind of total loathing which evil deserves. More, that glamour view of evil serves as a psychological screen of rationalization for those who permit themselves immoral actions. Emotionally and wordlessly, without any conscious philosophical identification, a man knows that he is immoral whenever he commits any actual immorality, because every actual immorality involves evasion, and evasion always leads to a sense of guilt. But the glamour view of evil helps an evader to evade his guilt. If he tells himself, "I'm bad," and the estimate invokes an image of Lucifer or Napoleon or, at worst, Humphrey Bogart, his pseudo-self-esteem might get a boost instead of the self-loathing he had dimly begun to feel, and will save him from any further, more honest identification. How many men would take their own moral self-doubt lightly, how many would be willing to live with it, if they realized fully that the image of evil is not Lucifer, but James Taggart? Only even James Taggart is too clean to stylize the version of it. Actual, realistic evil is a sluggish, blind, empty, malicious impotence, not to be feared or hated, but despised. A soul in the image of a combination cockroach, snail, and rat cannot inspire fear, only contempt and loathing.
Now, you might ask, but what is one to do if the majority of people hold irrational ideas? What does one do in an irrational society? The answer is A, do not accept their values, and B, do not permit yourself moral neutrality. This last is the particular form in which most people sanction evil and permit it to triumph. Most people are not evil, but neither are they moral originators, willing and able to create and uphold their own values. They accept the given by default. Do not help maintain their malevolent illusion that only evil is practical or possible on earth by giving it the sanction of your silence and your neutrality. If you are afraid to speak, if you remain neutral, you betray those who are not evil and who are struggling to create the kind of world you would like to see. That world will not be created for you by others, nor will you be fit for it if you deserted the battle. Moral neutrality is treason to those who are heroes. The only person who can profit from moral neutrality is the villain. In Dante's Divine Comedy, the lowest rung in hell is reserved, and rightly, for those who in times of moral crisis remain neutral. If you live in an irrational society as we do today, you cannot expect to be as happy as you would be in Atlantis. It is not within any individual's power to change the state of a whole society overnight. What he must be concerned with is only that which is within his power, namely his own values, actions, and choices. No matter what the state of the world around you, you will achieve the maximum of the happiness and success which it is objectively possible to achieve, only if you live your life by a rational code of values. There is no other alternative. If you know that your fellow men are blindly, irrationally rushing toward self-destruction, that is not the time to decide to join them. That is not the time to say, what can I do alone? I'd better follow their lead and jump off the cliff too. And now, finally, one last very important point. Just as evil has no power but that which it extorts from virtue, so the world is perishing today not from the presence of the bad, but from the absence of the good. From the widest political issues to the most personally private issues, the same principle obtains. The world is disintegrating not because of the presence of collectivists, but because of the absence of individualists. Not because of the presence of scoundrels, but because of the absence of heroes. Not because of the presence of stupidity, but because of the absence of intelligence. Not because of the presence of the Wesley Mouches, but because of the absence of the John Galt. If there are no men of reason, intelligence, and integrity in the world, the mere elimination of a Mouch or a Khrushchev will not create freedom and prosperity. If there are men of reason, intelligence, and integrity in the world, men who will fight for their values, the Mouches and Khrushchevs will fall of their own weight. The mere removal from office of a Roosevelt, a Truman, an Eisenhower, or a Kennedy would not be sufficient to return America to a free society, if there is no George Washington or Judge Narragansett to take their place. One does not create a positive merely by negating a negation. A positive has to be achieved by a positive. Suppose that you have written a great play, but no one is willing to produce it. Now you might feel that what stands in the way of your success are the producers who rejected your play. But identify the actual nature of your problem. It is not the presence of those bad producers, but the absence of one good one. Not the presence of men who can see, but the absence of a man who can see. If you find a producer with the intelligence and integrity to appreciate your play, the others do not matter. It is as though they did not exist. But if there is no good producer, the elimination of the bad ones will do nothing to advance your career. On a still more personal level, suppose that you are desperately lonely because you have found no one with whom you can fall in love. You feel only boredom or indifference toward the people you know. It is not those people who stand in the way of your romantic happiness. Their removal from your life will not provide you with a wife or husband. Only the discovery of a positive value can do that. Whenever you feel that you are frustrated in your happiness by the presence of the evil rather than the absence of the good, ask yourself a single question. If that particular evil did not exist, if somehow it were eliminated, would this provide you with the values and happiness you wanted?
Would eliminating your stupid friends give you an intelligent one? Would eliminating incompetence create ability? Would eliminating the employer who wouldn't give you a job provide you with employment? Evil does have the power to harm you and to stand in the way of your happiness in only one instance, when you are subjected to physical force. But you will not achieve a society of rights and freedom from coercion merely by shooting down any one particular gunman or dictator. Such a society has to be won by positive means, by establishing a rational code of ethics and a rational political system. And this is why it is so crucially important to fight for your values and not merely against evil. To those of you who have any lingering confusion about whether evil is to be feared or held in contempt, to those of you who have any doubts about its essential impotence, I should like to say that you will be free of the problem once and for all on the day when you fully understand and can give the answer that Rourke gives to Ellsworth Toohey, when Toohey, who has been plotting against Rourke for years, says to him, "Mr. Rourke, we're alone here. Why don't you tell me what you think of me? In any words you wish, no one will hear us." Rourke's answer is, "But I don't think of you." Good night, ladies and gentlemen.